I wanted to start with the sentence that I left off with last week. I just said it very quickly, but as I was just glancing over it again this morning, it's Kaufman wrote just a great summary, and so I wanted to reiterate that. And it is in the context of Acts 11, verse 18, when all of the Jews were thankful that God had granted to the Gentiles repentance to life. And so this great summary sentence that Kaufman left us off with, that we left off with last week, said, "A new day dawns and life springs eternal for all of mankind who will fear God and work righteousness." I thought, I don't know how long it took him to come up with that, but he had a real way with words, and this was I thought, a very good sentence. "A new day dawns and life springs eternal for all mankind who will fear God and work righteousness." So, now, today, what we'll plan to do, we're starting in Acts 11, verse 19, and it starts off, now that they have gotten it straight, had this, where Peter had the conference to explain his actions that he had with Cornelius up in Caesarea. This being Jerusalem here and Caesarea here, about, let me see, I think 50 miles or so from Jerusalem. And he got back to Jerusalem. He explained his actions, and everyone realized, and Peter had his six witnesses, that this was God's doing, and they didn't want to find themselves working against God. And so they decided that they better not be requiring circumcision or obedience to the old law, to the law of Moses, before baptism. And so they all came to that conclusion. Now, it didn't stick. There were others that came in, and this group known as those of the circumcision, and caused problems all the years down the line. But at least for right now, at this point, it was harmonious. Well, now, because of that, word has spread, and it has told everyone that they now realize we need to start teaching the Gentiles. So, and Luke does a little backtrack, a little flashback to the time when Stephen was stoned and when the young man known as Saul of Tarsus started persecuting the Christians, and they all the Christians except the 12 apostles left Jerusalem. They left for their lives. And he says that these Jewish Christians went to Phoenicia and to Antioch, and then he mentions two other places, well, also Cyprus. And then, by mentioning Antioch, that's where we're going to be spending a little time the next 2 weeks here, and this is a very important city. But then I wanted to go over these other two places that he mentions that the Jewish Christians came from and started to teach at Antioch. And it was Cyprus, here, this island here in the Mediterranean Sea, and also here, this city known as Cyrene. That's in modern-day Libya and here in North Africa. And Kaufman's comment was, Barnabas lived his hometown and family. He grew up here in Cyprus on this island. And so since Cyprus was mentioned, Kaufman felt like that probably, very likely, Barnabas was involved in organizing and orchestrating the teaching of the Gentiles here at Antioch. And definitely he is mentioned because when word came, I guess Barnabas went to Jerusalem, or he was in Jerusalem, and word came to the Christians in Jerusalem that now the they've been teaching the Gentiles, and they have great responses. There are many Gentiles becoming Christians now. And so their reply was for Barnabas to go here, and they needed to spend time and really work this area well, since God has obviously blessed them with increasing in God's kingdom. And so now Barnabas's idea is, I need to go get Saul. And at this time, he's back at home at his hometown in Tarsus. And so we won't get to this part this week, but that's what's coming in the next few verses. So he goes from Antioch and to Tarsus and gets Saul and brings him back. And that's where they teach for a whole year, the disciples. And the Lord's kingdom is increased greatly in this area. Now, since he brought up Cyprus and Barnabas was probably involved, here we've got Cyrene. And Cyrene is only mentioned, well, let me see, what was it? 3 or 4 times in the New Testament. But there's one person who is the most well-known Cyrenian. Name is Simon. He was the one who the Romans compelled and forced to carry Jesus' cross when Jesus fell beneath the load, heavy load of that cross. He was from Cyrene. So he at that time with Jesus, he had just come here to the Passover. And anyway, he didn't know anything about the Messiah or anything. And they forced him. He just happened to be, I guess, at the right place, right time. He might have thought initially is the wrong place at the wrong time. But anyway, now, we don't hear any more about Simon of Cyrene. But we do hear, Mark tells us that Simon had 2 sons, Rufus and Alexander. And we don't hear any more about Alexander, but we do about Rufus. And Paul talked very highly about him in one of his letters, and he was wanting the brethren to greet Rufus and his mother. So they were obviously Christians, and hopeful that Alexander was too, and definitely hopeful. And I think it's very logical that Simon had also become a Christian. And I didn't go back, but I think that Kaufman had talked about this in the past on those passages. And when he brought up all this, that it is a great possibility that Simon also became a Christian, and then his 2 sons and his wife. So with this of Cyrene, I don't know of any other only one other connection, but I think he would be a prime candidate, him or his sons, because there are men that came from Cyrene and Cyprus that went to Antioch to help teach initially at the very beginning, and they're the ones who started to evangelize this. Otherwise, it was, of course, it's a Roman city, a pagan city, a Gentile city full of Roman citizens. But they were very receptive to the gospel. But anyway, Simon may have been instrumental here since very likely Barnabas was instrumental with Cyprus. Simon or one of his sons were instrumental with Cyrene evangelizing and wanting to broaden their scope and decided to go to Antioch. Now, there's one other person that is mentioned from Cyrene, not well known, but it's in Acts 13, and his name is Lucius. And he is mentioned as one that was teaching here at Antioch. So he may have been the organizer, or it might have been Simon or Rufus or Alexander or all of those did the organizing. And then this Lucius of Cyrene came along with them. He might have just been one, or it could have been the organizer. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting to bring up a famous person from Cyrene that we know about. Well, we don't know. We just know initially, but he's well known, Simon of Cyrene, and interesting to realize even where it is on the map. It's here west of Egypt, and this is all the area in World War II where Italy was wanting to occupy with the Axis, and the British were fighting them all in this area. And Mussolini was not a good general at all, and so they were really English were really taken over from Italy, beating the Italian armies. But then that's when Hitler had to send in his the German tanks, and then that's the real famous their best generals who he sent, named Rommel, known the English called him the Desert Fox. But anyway, it was all in here that they battled in this area over time, a few years or whatever it was, until America showed up. And then that's when our great general known as Patton came, and then the Germans finally tucked tail and left. But anyway, that's here in North Africa in Cyrene, right here in this area. In Tunisia is to the west of here. They were all in that area. But anyway, also, I thought here, it's right here, close, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 miles from the Mediterranean Sea. So they did not walk all this way. They didn't travel by land. They've just gotten on a boat and gone over here anytime they were going to Jerusalem. And so it wasn't as burdensome of a journey to travel on land. They could travel in the sea. So any questions or comments on any of this? Okay, we'll start here in Acts 11 with verse 19. And Luke starts here saying, "Now those who were scattered after the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch." So when those had scattered, that the Jewish Christians had left Jerusalem, he says that they went to Phoenicia, that's this area in here, north of Tyre and Sidon. Well, in fact, it encompasses Sidon. And then Antioch and Cyprus. So that's the places where these Christians had traveled. And then they taught people everywhere they went. But of course, at that time, it's about to be stated, they were only teaching Jews. They were not teaching until this time. There were no Gentiles ever taught. Now, it would be a Gentile who was a Jewish convert known as a proselyte, and we have that example of the Ethiopian eunuch or the Ethiopian nobleman was an example of that. But they would not teach any Gentile that had not converted to Judaism until this time. So things are changing right here at this moment, and which this the rest of this sentence, they were preaching the word to no one but the Jews only. And Kaufman said about this verse, the third and final great section of Acts begins here with Acts 11:19, where the gospel message began to be taken to the ends of creation. Antioch was the scene of the first great Gentile congregation. Also, Antioch was where God gave the sacred name Christian to his people. And Antioch was where the former prosecutor, known later as Paul, began those labors which would determine to a large extent the future character of Christianity. The city was also known for its paganism and social depravity. And I'll plan to finish up with a page, somewhat of a short summary about Antioch, but he gave a little bit of an overview. But anyway, here he says that it was a pagan and socially depraved city. One must be amazed at the success the gospel had in this stronghold of immorality. It is a tribute to the power of the gospel of Christ when we see the transformation in the lives of men who are literally surrounded by sin in such cities as Corinth and Antioch. We can all rejoice that the blood of Christ can make the vilest sinner clean. As Peter's name and personality had dominated that previous section of Acts, Paul would dominate this last, third and last section. Verses 19 through 21 are a flashback in Luke's narrative, going back to Jerusalem. The memorable events are the death of the first martyr, that of course being Stephen, the first historical emergence of Saul of Tarsus, the dispersion of the disciples who went everywhere preaching the word, and the tribulation that accompanied those events. We have previously learned of the spread of the gospel by Philip to Samaria, Paul to Damascus, and Peter to Joppa and Caesarea. Now we learn the disciples have spread the gospel as far north as Antioch. And about the phrase, preaching the word to the Jews only, Kaufman said, despite the fact of the Great Commission having been intended for all nations, the first Christians understood this, or they misunderstood this as only all Jewish nations. So they were only going to spread the gospel in cities and nations where there were Jews. And if there were only Gentiles, they were going to skip them. They did not fully understand this. So, this fundamental misunderstanding lasted several years. The whole purpose of Christianity would have been nullified and thwarted if the world-saving gospel would have been reduced to the status of another Jewish sect. And there was no way that the Almighty God would have permitted such a thing. Acts chapters 9, 10, and 11 detail the dramatic, God-ordered events which stripped Christianity of its Jewish character and made a worldwide religion out of it. This preaching to the Jews only is soon to change as the news reaches these disciples that the Gentiles have now been accepted into God's kingdom. The gospel was sent to the Jews first, but now also to the Gentiles. Any questions or comments on anything here? Okay, verse 20. But then some of them were men from Cyprus and Cyrene. And that's these two places that we're talking about here, Cyrene and Cyprus, the island. And so some men from those two places, who when they had come to Antioch, spoke to the Hellenist, and that's an unfortunate translation that Kaufman will mention here, preaching the Lord Jesus. Now, the issue, Kaufman talked about a little bit, but I looked a little bit more in-depthly on the internet, and I found out why this got mistranslated, or got translated as Hellenist. And now we'll remember that Hellenist means Jews who could not speak Hebrew. They could only speak Greek. They were the Greek-speaking Jews. And they were looked down upon by the Jews who could speak Hebrew. But anyway, they could only speak Greek as the other Gentiles. And they had lost that and hadn't learned it. And as a result, this didn't just start here. It was back in the Old Testament days. Actually, I think it was more in the 400 years of God's silence that there were no prophets, and God did not communicate with mankind or any of the Jews during that time. I think that was the period. And so as a result, a large number of the Jews couldn't even read the Hebrew to read the Old Testament. And so the council came up with what they call Septuagint. There were 70 scholars that translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek. And then that translation is known as the Septuagint. Septuagint meaning 70. And so it was 70 translators, and so that was the reason. Now, the word should, and what it is, there's what is called a textual variant, meaning that there are several different manuscripts. There's the Masoretic text, the Nestle text, there's other text, and some of those texts state, have the Greek word for Hellenist, and that's why it got translated this way, at least in the King James. But there were other texts that had the Greek word for Hellenes, meaning that they were Greeks, they were Gentiles, and that is what is meant here, and what Kaufman says, it's very clear and plain. This is a contrast that where before they were teaching only the Jews, but now they're teaching the Gentiles. That's the contrast. Not that they were teaching Jews only, and so now they went to Antioch and they're teaching Greek-speaking Jews. No, they weren't teaching the Jews at all. For the first time, they started evangelizing Gentiles. And then this word, which comes in some of the manuscripts, but obviously not what the King James was using, but it should have been Hellenes, meaning the Gentiles. Any questions or comments on this? Okay, I'll read here what Kaufman says, and to clarify this about this phrase, spoke to the Hellenist. It is unfortunate that the Hellenist, meaning the Greek-speaking Jews, was translated here. It is clear that Gentiles are meant, which is the only proper contrast of Jews only in the preceding verse. The statement that the men of Cyprus and Cyrene preached the gospel to them is contrasted with the action of others who preached to the Jews only. Obviously, therefore, these Greeks were not Jews. These men of Cyprus and Cyrene received the credit for being the first to preach the gospel systematically to Gentiles. It is very probable that Barnabas would have been among them. And when he stated that, among them from Cyprus, that's when I came up and I thought, you know what? Simon of Cyrene may have played a very good part in that too, or his sons. This preaching to the Gentiles did not take place until after the news of Peter's baptism of Cornelius, which had been circulated, and to the time that the baptism of Cornelius had been circulated. Once they heard that the Gentiles were now accepted into God's kingdom, they did not hesitate to take the gospel to the great Gentile center of Antioch. Antioch, which Kaufman will bring this up to, but it is the third largest city, and they have estimates and believe that Antioch was a population of 500,000 in the first century. And I'd looked that up on the internet, and that's exactly what they said on the internet too. But anyway, so Kaufman's research, that's what he had found. And so it was a big city. In fact, it was the third largest city in all the Roman Empire. And it was known as the great queen of the queen city of the East, the queen city of the East. And it had all kind of good architecture, the Roman architecture, and they had lots of arts and had built lots of different structure for their plays and different things. It would have been, maybe like New York of our cities that's known to have a lot of culture is what the secular people would call it, and they would have had a lot of culture. Now, it was all pagan, ungodly things, but for the Roman times, this was a very bustling and a modern city for the Romans, and they were very proud of Antioch. And this is where God, and as events went through, this was the first Gentile congregation in the entire world, was right here at Antioch. So that's how important what this is. And so any questions or comments on any of this? That's a good question. That's a very good question. And now, they won't have known anything about any of it of any sort. But now, what happened to Antioch in the time during the Roman Empire, a big city, 500,000? Well, when the Roman Empire imploded, well, over the years, 100 years ago, and Kaufman brought this up, and I looked it up. It was 100 years ago in 1930 is what it said. Antioch was down to 30,000 people. So they had really, they'd gone down 30,000, maybe a little bit bigger than Altus, is all from 500,000. And but now I looked, they built in the last 100 years, they built back up, and they list them at 400,000 to 500,000 population now, even today. So I don't know. I imagine anyone that would go there, they would have tour guides that if you pay them money, they would like to show you places that they could claim and probably historical. But I'm going to say that, no, probably once, for sure, once the Roman Empire imploded and then the town drastically dried up to less than 10%, 7%, 8% of their original population, I'm going to say any evidence, archaeological evidence would probably have been lost. But that is a good thought that I had not thought about. And now, you know, they're going to take first claim on everything. Which is unfortunate because they didn't even start until about 400 AD. You know, nearly 400 years after this time. So this would have been a well-established 400-year-old congregation. And maybe 100 or 200 AD, there was a historian that said at that time the population was about 200,000, and he said there were 100,000 Christians. You know, that might have been, I think that was Eusebius, I think is what I found was the source of that. And about half of Antioch, now their population had dropped from the first century to this second century or so, cut in half, but of that 200,000, half of them were Christians is what he had recorded. So that's how instrumental and all, and the great teaching, obviously, headed by Paul and Barnabas, which we'll learn here in Acts 11:26, that Paul and Barnabas, and I'm assuming these others, but anyway, Paul and Barnabas were the ones leading the way. They taught with them a whole year here in Antioch, and they obviously laid a solid foundation that lasted a long time. So that's a very historical, this is a very historical passage here about this with Antioch. And of course, most important. Now they're teaching the Gentiles, and start from here. Now they're going to start and spread the gospel to the entire world, because now they realize to every nation didn't mean only nation that included had Jews in it. And now it's going to be all over the globe. Every nation under the sun will be taught. And boy, did they do it. They evangelized the entire world in about 25 years, which is very remarkable. And you know, these men, there were, of course, no mosque grew under their feet. They were the Rolling Stones that couldn't gather any moss, and they really got after it, the apostles with these other Christians, and you know, and many, many others, of course, that are never even mentioned. Any other questions or comments?